All right, let's get started. And it has been officially requested that the teachers for the board out there be changed and take my name completely off. So in about a week and a half, I'll be taken off. Who's that?
Greg?
Yeah? Okay. Well, I'm teaching next quarter, so I'm already slated. That's all.
Are you sure?
Will you be my backup? Well, I'm back hopefully for a long time. I just wanted to go over the map just for a second. You know, it's a real good thing to have the kids do and have them be able to do this in their, be able to do it in their mind. But first, you know, on a board. So something like, and the more crude the, well, in my case, it has to be. So. And some of the places that we're going to study tonight we'll put on there. But here's some of the, if you remember, some of the rivers and things as they go, the Yarmouk, the Javik. I told you how to remember those, right? Remember? And then from A to Z, Yarmouk, Javik, and then A to Z, Arnon and Zered. So when you draw Mount Carmel, kind of juts down about the same spot as the Sea of Galilee, just to kind of put it in kind of a perspective. Some of the places we're going to talk about tonight in this lesson, we'll have Tyre and Sidon. Jesus will pass through there. Caesarea, somewhere in here. Caesarea Philippi, he'll be there. Remember, Mount Hermon is on right up in there, in that area, I believe. He's going to pass through the area of Dalmanutha, also called Mageddon. He'll go through Decapolis, which is all of this area. Kind of stops about halfway there in that region. Trying to think what else. I think that's all the areas we'll be going through in this lesson. But just practice that. You know, you can take 3 or 4 minutes before class starts even and kind of rehearse that. Okay, and there's a map. You can always have that in the PowerPoint and go with it there as well. Okay, all right, we're in Mark chapter 7. And if you want to turn over there, we'll have it on the slides as well. We're actually, I don't have it on the slides, so actually before we even get to that one, just catch up from where Brent left off in Mark chapter 7, the few verses before that, in verses 24 through 30. And that's the story of the he's going through Tyre and Sidon region, and he's wanting to get away from the crowds. He's needing to get with his disciples. There's a lot of I don't know if I'd say pressure, but there's several different groups of people who are out to get him now, to do him harm. And so he's trying to get away from them and be able to do his business. So he's in the area of Tyre and Sidon, up in the northwest along the coast. And he goes into a house there. And he's trying to keep it quiet so that no one knows that he's there. But it gets out, and a woman comes, and she has a daughter who has an unclean spirit. And she comes to him, and she's in dire straits. She's begging for Jesus' help for her daughter. And she believes with all her heart that Jesus can do this. then she comes to him, she falls down at his feet, and she says, "Have mercy on me, Lord, O Lord, Son of David." But Jesus doesn't answer her right away. His disciples come to him and say, send her away. You know, she's, and I guess in a sense, she's bothering us. She keeps crying after us. Jesus does answer her, and he says that he is not, he was not sent to any but the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So his purpose is to the lost sheep of Israel. That's who he's come for at this time. But she keeps crying out to him, "Lord, help me." Now, when he says that, what class is she in? She's not of that house of Israel. Tyre and Sidon, you know, the Phoenicians, the Gentiles, right? So, and as Jesus goes around, his miracles and his signs and the wonders that he did, they weren't in those areas, were they? They were focused in the areas where the Jews lived, the house of Israel. And that was by design. But she's wanting desperately for her daughter to be healed, and she knows that Jesus can do this. And she still begs and pleads with him, Lord, help me. And Jesus replies, he said, "It's not fitting to take the children's food away and give it to the dogs, the little dogs." It's not an insult to her. It's more of, it's the idea of taking food away from the children and giving it to anyone, to an animal or something. And it's just not fitting to do that. And the point was that he was here for the Jews, to get them ready. Now, it was going to be the Gentiles' time. That was coming, but it just wasn't. This wasn't that time. And you know, it was kind of the idea that, you know, if in a sense, if he started doing miracles and signs, maybe this is just my thinking, in these areas in the Gentile territories, then it would create a whole host of maybe other issues for him that it wasn't time for that. But whatever Jesus told her that he was not sent for that reason, and she answers him very succinctly and rightly. She says that is right, Lord, but the dogs do eat scraps that fall on the floor. You know, that's right. And so you can just imagine, you know, Jesus had a lot of compassion, and this was the perfect answer to what she was pleading, what he was saying. And he gives in, and he does that miracle, and he says, go your way, your daughter's healed. And just a real, the stories are nice, they're warming, they're heartfelt, and they make you feel good, but they're designed, to increase our faith. And that's how we need to get our children, teaching them that. Yeah.
And what I think is, in the readings of life, you have people come to him, like, give us a sign. He doesn't.
Well, that's coming next. Go ahead.
But what he does here is he takes somebody who has humbled themselves. What she says, she puts herself at the lowest state she can put herself. I mean, she's like, "I understand that, but even us dogs." I mean, you know, she has put herself at the lowest point. She is showing humility.
Yes.
And I think because of that, he heals her daughter.
It's certainly a characteristic that Jesus will admire in others. I mean, he showed the greatest. So, good point.
And the two miracles that we know of were Christ, for the miracle, for Gentiles. In both cases, they exist. exemplified traits that he would have liked to have seen in some people. He had a centurion who understood authority. He understood the authority of the cross now. With the eyes of the Jews that understood that. And here is this Gentile giving him this object lesson. And then the lady here with her faith and her humility. Again, a Gentile, the opportunity he has used a Gentile in an object lesson to his own people and putting them to shame in many ways.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
In both those cases, he was mentioned. First of the idea was not present.
Was not what, I'm sorry?
Present.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, good point. It's just a shame that, you know, that the Jews who had this such rich history of the nation of Israel and being God's people, that a lot of them just didn't understand or didn't want to. Okay. Very good. All right. So, go ahead into verse 31 of Mark chapter 7. And we have the story here that he leaves the coast of Tyre and Sidon. So he's up here in this area, and he comes over to the Sea of Galilee. And it gives the indication that he kind of came down in this area. That may have been in the Matthew, but he comes down to the coast of Decapolis. So he comes over down into the southwest area of Galilee is where he comes to. And they bring to him one who's deaf, who can't speak, and they bring this man to him to be healed. And in this case, verse 33, he takes this man aside. So he takes him, you know, kind of away from the multitude, kind of where they're off to the side or maybe even alone. And he takes him and he puts his fingers in his ears. He takes spittle and touches his tongue, spits and touches his tongue. And he looks to heaven and he cries and he says, "Ephatha," or that is, "be opened." And straightway, immediately, the man's ears were opened. He could hear, and his tongue was loosed, and he was able to speak clearly and plainly. And he gives him a charge, and he's given others the same charge, to not go and tell anyone. Don't tell anyone. But the more he seemed to give that admonition, the more they go out and do that. And I think we've made the point. Not sure we made. I think we made the point in here. You know, even if we don't understand the commands that we read, that Jesus gives us, that God gives us. Like in this case, you know, it seems pretty logical in my mind, in man's mind, a human mind, to go out and tell everybody. This needs to be publicized. Who this is, what he's doing. But Jesus has his reasons, and we have an idea of that, you know, even if you don't understand why the command is there and why Jesus tells us something, we need to do it. We need to obey it and not question it. You know, I think that's an important lesson, especially when you're you know, in the teenage years and, you know, you want an answer, you know, because mom says or because dad says, you know, isn't really enough, you know, at that age, you know, right? Should be, but here's a good lesson when they go out and do that, when they go out and disobey this, it creates real problems for Jesus in getting around and you know, even for his I don't know if you'd say prolonging his life until the appointed time that these things need to happen. So, all right. Okay, very good. Okay, so from he calls his disciples to him, and he's been teaching the multitudes still in that same area, and he it's been 3 days. 3 days pass, and this multitude has come to him to perhaps hear him, to perhaps see the miracles, and he has compassion on the multitude because they haven't had anything to eat. Nothing's been brought, and they're out in a desert area where there's not any thing for them to get and to eat. And he knows in verse 3 that if he sends them away to their own houses, or some of them are, you know, live far away, if he sends them away, they're not going to they'll faint by the way. They're because of a lack of food. And his disciples answer him and say, "Well, where are we going to get food down in, you know, out here? There's nothing to be had out here." And he asks them, "How many loaves do you have?" So we start a familiar story. It's happened before this way. "How many loaves do you have?" And they came back and they said, "We have 7." And so he said, commands everybody to sit down on the ground. He takes the 7 loaves. He gives thanks for them. And he begins distributing them out. They also have some fish. And he also begins distributing them. And they pass it out. And the whole multitude is able to eat and to be filled in verse 8. And they had leftovers. Had 7 baskets left over, and then that multitude, there was 4,000 that they fed, that Jesus provided food for, you know, that day. And the you know, as they begin to leave from there, they get in the boat and they cross over, and they're going to Dalmanutha, and that's over here on the west side. So they're going to cross over the Sea of Galilee, but before he as he gets over there, when he arrived, there were Pharisees and Sadducees who were there, and they want to see a sign. And in this case, they specifically ask to see a sign from heaven. Perhaps meaning that literally, that they wanted to see something. And, you know, from the prophets, that had happened in the past. Samuel, in his day, caused thunder and rain to come. Isaiah had caused the sun, the shadow on the sundial to stop. In different occasions, things like that had happened. But Jesus is distressed with them, frustrated with them perhaps, and he sighs deeply, and he says, "Why does this generation keep asking for a sign?" And he says that when it's evening, you say it will be fair weather because the sky is red. You can look off and you can see you can kind of read the signs of the weather and see what's happening. In the morning, it'll be foul weather if the sky is red and lowering. And he says, you can see that, you can discern that, but you can't understand what's happening right here in front of you. You can't see what's happening, the signs of the times. And, you know, all of the wonders, the miracles that he's doing, they're just dismissing, just completely dismissing. Because they have their own preset ideas, their own way, their own traditions, their own everything. It's all about what they already have. And they don't They're not opening up their minds to see what's happening. And, you know, that's the same thing that we can face today with ourselves, with not having an attitude of being open-minded and seeing the Scriptures and wanting to understand what God's telling us. We can see that with others in the world who, you know, kind of in the same position where, you know, they've been taught this tradition all along, and it's just, you know, the blinders are on and there's no other way. He says, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. There will be no sign but the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he goes away from them. Obviously referring to Jonah in was it Matthew 12? The sign of Jonah being 3 days in the whale and the fish. And don't say what. But referring to his death and being in the grave 3 days and rising up. All right. Okay. And continuing on in Mark chapter 8. So they get back in the boat and they're going to cross over the Sea of Galilee again. And this time they're going to kind of go up to the northeastern side, to Bethsaida. And as they're going along, or getting ready to go, or in process, or already on the way, the disciples realize that they didn't pack any food, any bread. They didn't bring any bread with them. And so that was on their minds. And Jesus is thinking about the... you know, what the Pharisees and the Sadducees were asking him, just now on the there at Dalmanutha. And he tells the disciples, and he says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And the disciples, you know, when Jesus says that, the disciples think, we forgot the bread. Well, he's talking about we can't get bread from the Pharisees. Right? So that was their understanding. You know, it's, you know, one person is thinking along this line of thought, and the other is over here, and they're just on two different thoughts. And Jesus heard them or knew what they were saying, and he says, "Why are you reasoning because you don't have any bread? Don't you understand? Don't you get it?" And he says, "Perceive you not, and neither understand? Have you your heart yet hardened? Have your eyes not seen? Your ears not heard? Do you not remember?" And, you know, he's kind of letting them have it here. You know, why don't you understand? I guess, you know, it may be to the point where Jesus, things are coming down, it's getting close, you know, to what Jesus has come here for. And they need to know, they need to understand more than they understand at this point, I guess. And, he goes back and he says, you know, back earlier, when I took the 5 loaves and fed 5,000, how many did you have left over? When I took the 7 loaves just now on the other side of the sea, you know, how many, not on the other side, but on this side, how many did you take up, you know, after we fed the 4,000? Bread's not a problem, you know. Bread is not the issue here. And after he had said that, in Matthew's account, it says in verse 12 of chapter 16, it says, it clicked. You know, the disciples understood. Oh, he's not talking about the bread that we forgot. He's talking about the leaven of the Pharisees. He's talking about what they're teaching, what they're doing, what they're teaching the people. He's warning us about that. So, all right. All right, he's over in, they arrive over at Bethsaida, and they bring a blind man to him, and they want him to heal this blind man. And he takes the blind man and leads him out of the town. So again, he takes this man outside of town, whether the people followed him or they're alone outside of town. But he takes him away, and he spits on his eyes, puts his hands on him, and asks him, "Do you see anything?" And he says, I see men as trees. You know, the motions there, the faint figures, blurry, fuzzy, you know, however it looked. But he can see motion and he can see objects. And Jesus puts his hands on his eyes again and has him look, and everything was restored. His eyes were clear. He could see clearly. And he sends him away to his house. You know, don't tell it in the town. Don't tell it to anyone anywhere. So don't even go into town or tell it there. Now this event is different from all the other miracles that Jesus did. And the question that I've asked myself, and I'll go ahead and say it's a horrible question, but the question that I've asked and others ask is, why did it take Jesus two times? Well, or maybe an adult would say, well, why was it required, you know, two times to do this? Well, in that question, what all you have to, if somebody asks that question, say, well, let's rephrase that question. Why did Jesus choose to do this in two phases? You see the difference between those questions. One shows an element of taking power away from Jesus, a lack of belief, really, right? The other shows belief, that this was just the way Jesus chose to do it this time. Why did Jesus do it this way this time? Why did Jesus choose to do it this way? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I could speculate with you about it, but the Bible doesn't tell us any more about that. That question will usually come up with the kids as they get older. But I wouldn't even get into it with the smaller ones. They'll believe it when you tell them. Okay? All right. Yes. That's right. Yeah. This was not a difficult task. What'd you say? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. He did what? Yeah. Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. The next few verses Mark, in verses 27 through 30. And when I put those up there, I should have put Matthew. And you might just want to turn to Matthew. More information to Matthew on this. But it's in Matthew 16, verses 13 through 20. And they go from Bethsaida on up to Caesarea Philippi. So they were Bethsaida, we didn't mark, but they go from there on up to Caesarea Philippi, to the north. And they're kind of on the way, about to arrive there. They came into that district. He was asking his disciples, so what was he doing on the way? They were talking. He was teaching. You know, probably everywhere he went, he was talking to them and teaching them. I would guess that we have very little of what he, you know, told them and taught them and instructed them. What we have is wonderful. And he's asking them, he says, well, who do people say that the Son of Man is? What do people think about the Son of Man? And And they replied, well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, others, you know, Jeremiah, one of the other prophets. Okay? And all of those are plausible answers, you know. But he says, who do you say that I am? So he's wanting to find out from them, what do they know? What do they think? And Peter, forward as ever, he answers out first. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answers back, and he says, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, or Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. And I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. So what Peter answers is spot on. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus says that on this rock, Peter, Petros, I don't get much into Greek, but when he says, thou art Peter, you are Peter, he uses the word Petros, from what I looked up. And when he says, upon this rock, he uses the form of that word, a feminine form of that word. Y'all may know Greek better than me. You can correct me if I've got this wrong. But essentially, you are Peter, Petros, refers more to a small stone, a piece of stone, or a rock, one you could hold. But Petra, in this form, meaning a mass rock, a massive rock, foundation, a bedrock maybe. So he says, you are Peter, and upon this rock, I will build my church. I don't really see Peter as being, you know, this kind of a massive. He did a lot. I mean, he and in a sense, you know, I completely believe that he's talking about the fact that Jesus is the Christ, and that's the upon that fact that Jesus is going to build the church. Do you think about Peter and what his role is? And he plays a very prominent role in what happens in the beginning of the church. He's the first one to preach on the day of Pentecost to the Jews in that setting. He's the first one to preach to the Gentiles, to Cornelius in chapter 10. Peter is definitely a force in his life for good. And he says in verse 19, I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth. So, talking to Peter still, I'll give you the keys of the kingdom, the teaching of the gospel. You know, here's the keys. This will unlock all the mysteries. You know, what's been hidden. And he says to Peter, whatever you bind on earth. And this is where some of the translations, you know, have really differing ideas. See up there, and that's the King James. Oh, I didn't put it up there. No, I didn't keep going. Sorry. I didn't get all of it up there. But in this version it says, whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. So, the idea that, you know, whatever Peter was going to be teaching was going to be exactly what was the truth that came from heaven. He was going to get that instruction from, he was going to get that truth from where? from heaven, from the Holy Spirit, right? And the same place that we get it from, right? And he was going to have that information. And whatever had been bound in heaven is exactly what he would bind on earth. Whatever was loosed. So exactly what was coming from God was exactly what he would be teaching and requiring of the people, exactly what God would require. And this wasn't just for Peter. This wasn't exclusively for him, to put him in some kind of different position. But in Matthew 18, verse 18, that same exact verbiage, he tells to the others. And he says in verse 18, "Truly I say, whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven." The King James, and I think the American Standard maybe, word that differently and gives the impression that whatever is bound on earth will be bound in heaven. You know, giving you an impression that it's opposite of the way it actually occurred. If that doesn't make sense. So, just something to be aware of when you're teaching. All right, any comments or questions?
Ben, we're hard on Peter sometimes, and rightfully so. Peter steps up a couple of times.
He steps up a lot.
He sure does.
I think.
And
if I'm gonna blame blast him, mm-hmm. then I need to duck an awful lot. Oh, go ahead.
When the disciples are leaving, you don't want to go too, do you? Well, who we're going to do to you? Mm-hmm. And now again, you say that. You know,
Peter,
right? And we're hard on him sometimes, right? So he's pretty, he's got, the Lord saw something in him, and he used it.
Yeah.
Where you put that seems really important that we understand, and the kids understand that. All scriptures are given by the inspiration of God. The word inspiration literally means God breathed. But these guys were not speaking things on their own. They were speaking what God told them to speak. That's the reason it's important to take the whole counsel of God and make sure that we're studying when the kids are certain that they understand this isn't like a cafeteria plan. You can take bits and pieces. You have to take it all or none of it.
Yeah, that's right. Very good. Good point. Okay. Well, that's all I have. We will take up from there next week, and we'll see you then.